and welcome to episode 102 of Two Chairs Talking. My name is Perry Middlemas, and I'm here on my own today. I'm usually here with my friend and co-host David Grigg, but this time I'm flying solo. David is actually here lurking, working as he always does on the technical side of the podcast, and we couldn't get by without him. Anyway, the reason I'm here on my own is because the content of today's episode is a recording of a panel I ran at Conflux, which was the Australian National Science Fiction Convention held in Canberra in October 2023. David wasn't there. Just myself and my fellow panellists, Lee Edmonds and Alan Stewart, with help from the audience. The topic of the panel was fanzines, the state of the art. As with all such recordings, there will be times where the audio is hard to hear, especially when members of the audience are asking questions. We don't actually have a roving mic, which we really should do, but we don't because we're not really organised. Anyway, hopefully the answers will provide the context. So anyway, here it is. I'll see you on the other side. All right. Hello and welcome to this panel at Conflux regarding fanzines. My name is Perry Middlemas. I'm joined here by my esteemed colleague Lee Edmonds and my other esteemed colleague Alan Stewart, all variously from Victoria at the moment, but an all-Australian. So I'm sorry, this is sort of going to be an Australian-based fanzine panel, but we will be dealing with a number of issues regarding fanzines from around the world. And so I would like to start this particular panel by being controversial right from the very beginning by coming up with a definition of what a fanzine actually is. And this is where we can all have conversations later on. I go back to the Fan Awards Administrator, Nick Fari, who's basically said, a fanzine, and he has that in quotes, for our purposes, take note of that, is defined as an immutable artefact, once published, not subject to revision or modification. The fanzine might not exist in physical form. A PDF, for example, is an artefact, as is a podcast.
He doesn't think a podcast is?
I do. I do believe as long as it's immutable and you don't go back and change it afterwards. So that's really the basic idea.
Sometimes they do.
So basically, that's where I'm coming from, and I believe that that probably pretty much is where the other two of them on the panel are coming from. But do you have any comments on that?
Well, I've just spent 2.5 days in the National Library reading old fanzines for historical research. Some of those fanzines go back to the early 50s. And they, as you say, they're immutable, they're stuck in time. When you hold a fanzine published in 1952, you're actually holding 1952 in your hands. It's a statement of what... There are many assumptions in old fanzines that maybe you don't understand, maybe you do. But the point of them is they're a statement about what these people thought, about what their lives were like, what science fiction was like in those days. They're a window to the past. So I find that... Well, look, the other thing about it quite simply is I'm looking at a fanzine and I suddenly realise I was at the collating party where we put... and here I am in the National Library. But the point of... The thing I like about fanzines, and I do involve myself in other forms of media, is that it is immutable. It is actually stuck. It relates you to the past. Now, when I produce a fanzine like Grataplan there, it's not for the future. It's produced for you readers today. And if you don't have a copy, grab a copy. It's produced so that I communicate with you today about stuff. We're at a science fiction convention, so some of that might be about science fiction. But fanzines begin in 1930 with the comet. And they've mutated since then to all kinds of things. But the ones that are most interesting to me are the ones in which people talk about themselves. So that it's a statement of, or not a statement, a discussion actually, about what it was like you know, for example, to live in McCarthy America, what it was like to live in Menzies Australia. Mm-hmm. Now, these things weren't deliberate. They weren't put there deliberately because someone's writing about the problems they had getting to the post office or the mail deliveries or the cost of stamps or anything like that. But they record in a way that lots of other things don't. And I have to actually say that libraries have discovered the value of fanzines as a form of folk, sort of folk culture almost. This is why there are good collections of fanzines that I know of in Sydney University, Monash University, Adelaide University and Murdoch University in Western Australia, because they see these not as we produce them, as stuff that we're talking to each other with. They see them as records of the past in a way in which most other social groups don't produce. Because of the way that we are writers, and all fanzine writers, people involved in fanzines are writers, they're just not science... Sorry, actually a lot of them are science fiction writers. As I said before we started, I'm looking at a fanzine I produced in 74, and there's Bob Tucker and Chris Priest and several other writers who are in fact well-known, or were well-known writers, also writing for fanzines, but they're writing about the stuff that's not for sale, isn't... anyhow, the thing is that we're all writers, we're all communicating different levels of what we're thinking about. Some of it's about science fiction. For example, if you go to ASFR and you read George Stirner, you can read George Stirner talking about science fiction, but in there, if you read the way he writes, you read the thoughts of a person who was brought up during the Depression, who lived through the 50s. He won what's the name of the famous book prize?
Miles Franklin.
That kind of personality comes through in the words. But going back to your point, it's all recorded because it's on a piece of paper. You can't change it. Now, what interests me the most, and you guys will talk about this some more, what interests me the most is the way in which the technology that we used formed the way in which we communicated. And if you remember the Facebook thing from, was it the Worldcon Before Last, where they had set up a mock-up of Bob Tucker's room.
It was a Tricon last year, yeah.
Tricon. But a beautiful thing, and they had the duplicator and the typewriter. What we have to remember is that the duplicator and the typewriter were technologies of the 1920s, 1930s. Science fiction fans took these new innovations and they used them almost instantly to create a form of communication. You take your typewriter, you take your duplicator, you take the postal system. And I still remember the days when you got 11 mail deliveries a week. And there was something in every mail delivery. But they took these three technologies and they put them together and they invented a form of communication that, as far as I know, is unique in the Western world. So that by putting these together, they start off talking about science fiction, but they soon discover that there's more to people than just science fiction readers. So by the end of the 1930s, in America in particular, they're writing about their lives in a way. They're communicating as more than science fiction readers. They're communicating as people who read science fiction. And science fiction is what brings people together. The thing that's not obvious, we have forgotten, is that science fiction was a derided form of literature. It was a pulp form of literature in the 1930s. In fact, it was a pulp form of literature and a derided form of literature up until Star Trek and Star Wars. Star Trek and Star Wars changed the way in which the populace sees science fiction. If you go to Netflix and Disney, which is the two I've got these days, there's so much science fiction and fantasy, it's just unbelievable. Most of us hardly was looking at that, but this was always the case. But this group of people who were devotees of this new form of literature, new in terms of Hugo Gernsback and Amazing Stories, discovered this form of literature, discovered each other, formed a community. How does this community, which is widespread across the United States of America, and then across Britain and then across Australia. How does this mob communicate? Well, they communicate by writing to each other, but that's not as efficient as discovering that you can actually put something in a typewriter, bang on the keys, and produce something that you can duplicate, you can create a number of copies of, and then you can send out to a whole community of people. And that helps to create the community and bind the community together. And so this goes on. This went on from, say, I think it was almost mature by the mid-1930s. Some of the fanzines I've seen from the late 1930s are in form, in technological form, are the same, apart from the printing of this thing, production of these things, are exactly in the same form. The form change begins to change with the begin. Well, actually, it starts to change with photocopiers, because then you can do the kinds of things you couldn't do before. Just tracking back, the thing that struck me from looking at these old fanzines, say from the 50s and early 50s and 60s, is that the fanzine editors had actually turned this from a mode of communication into an art form, or at least a craft form. The way in which they could use type to do headings, put linos in, all the different things they could do, with shading plates, with styluses. We in Australia got on to using electronic stencils in the mid-1950s to put art into fanzines. But before that, you had to actually draw onto whichever medium. If you're doing a spirit duplicated, or whether you're doing a Ronio thing, you had to learn to draw onto something that was then being reproduced. Drawing onto stencil is an absolute art in itself, which I never mastered. But you look at some of these fanzines, and what with their ability to draw straight onto stencil and then use shading plates to fill them in, they're little works of art in themselves. And they had got this to a fine state by the end of the 1970s. And then photocopiers come along. And suddenly the refined art that they developed just disappeared very quickly. Photocopiers also changed the way in which people looked at what they were doing. It became less of a craft and just write on a piece of paper, glue some bits, pictures to a piece of paper, you've produced a fanzine. Now, to some extent, the reason for the fanzine was the same, communication, but it morphed to me, in general speaking, into the zine culture. And if you want to look at zines, the State Library of Victoria has deliberately collected zines, not fanzines. The difference between zines and fanzines is zines don't talk to each other. Fanzines talk to each other, fanzine fans talk to each other. So when Nick Fahey produces an issue of this year, emails it to everyone, puts it on a fanzine, we're all talking to each other. I read what Eli Cohen or Jerry Kaufman or this fella here have written, and so we're communicating. I know what he's... Well, how would you know what he's thinking?
I don't know.
Likewise. Actually, I have to write it on a piece of paper so I know what I'm thinking. That's one. So one of the reasons. One of the reasons for actually writing is to know what you're thinking about. Anyhow, so this thing has developed. It's the technology that has shaped the fanzine. But it's going back to the Tucker thing at Tricon. It had a little poster at the front that said, "Social networking before social networks." And so these guys had discovered a form of internet from the 1930s that used the postal system rather than the new electronic system. And it's just that we in Australia got used to the idea that instead of me writing something and duplicating and sending it off, instead of me getting a response next minute or next day, I would get a response next month. In Britain, I imagine, if you posted the fanzine, you get a response next week.
Yeah, so you start to get letters in a couple of days.
Yeah, whereas in Australia, apart from Australian fanzines, Australian fans, that's the other thing about Australian fanzines at different times. Yesterday I came across an article that Ron Clark had written at the end of the 60s And he says about the explosion of Australian fanzines. The beginning of the 1960s, there was four fanzines produced. It was probably about 62. Four fanzines produced in Australia in about 1962. In 1960, I would say 69, there were 118 produced in Australia. Something had happened in that period. What had actually happened was Australian Science Fiction Review, which I shall write about. You'll be able to read the results of my research in 3 years' time, because I've given up trying to race these things. What had happened is that this technology of communicating with each other there's a whole bunch of people. Also, there's a change in culture in Australia, which has got to do with that, which I will unpack later when I figured out what it is, because then I'll write it down. Change in culture. There's a bunch of young people, of which I was one, discovered that we could communicate outside Australia in a way that other Australians couldn't do. So that, for example, I'm reading Hank and Leslie's Starling. I'm reading reviews that Ted White has written of seeing Janis Joplin, Big Brother and the Holding Company, in New York. And someone's writing about seeing Jefferson Airplane in Los Angeles. And so I know what's happening in America in popular culture before anyone else in Australia does. So that when these records arrive, I think it's about time this bloody record arrived. So that we in Australia discovered that we could communicate outside of the limited, restricted Australian culture, that we could connect ourselves with what was happening in Britain and what was happening in the United States. To some extent, something that was happening in the 30s in Australia. We're producing fanzines in Australia because we want to be part of that international culture. A lot of fanzine production in Australia in the late 30s and in the 60s is so that we can communicate with what's going on overseas. Because remember Australia in... Well, you're so young. Remember Australia in the... if you can, in the 1960s, a very restricted, a very limited... I was reminded by reading all the material that Gary Mason and Paul Stevens wrote about censorship in Australia in the first half of the 1960s. I remember us looking at a movie. We watched Son of Frankenstein, and that was a banned film. And in fact, if I remember, we went to a drive-in theatre where it was shown, only print in Australia, and the story was that as the print was coming out of the projector, something was wrong and it was splitting the film, so it was the only time it was shown. So that all this stuff that we now take for granted was in this restricted society we lived in. So we produced fanzines, partly as our own expression for us to actually express ourselves, but also to be in touch with people in a way that we could not. These days we can, it's very easy. The internet, the World Wide Web, it's all there for us. Is that place to start?
Well, it's very interesting that just goes to show you that I haven't moderated a panel for quite some time because 20 minutes in, I can now tell you what this panel's about. I started off by throwing to you as a definition, and then you just ran with it. And that's basically what fans do, especially in fanzines. You pick up one topic and you run with it. What this fanzine panel was going to talk about was the past, and I think they've had a pretty good run through with that, even though I thought he was only going to talk about what a bloody fanzine is, and what else is happening in the present.
Yep.
And what else is going to be happening in the future. But there's a very interesting point that you made in the middle of all of that, which links from very beginning all the way right through to the very end, and also goes to what we were talking about in terms of the definition, and that is the use of the word technology.
Yep.
What the technology is at the time at which the fanzine or the fanish production was made. Back in the 1930s, right through until the 1960s, it was stencils of some description.
Office technology
of some... In many sense, it still is.
Yeah.
But basically what it comes down to is that fans have picked up that office technology very, very early and run with it.
Yep.
Figured out what they could use it for and just kept on extending it and pushing it as far as it could possibly go. You were saying to me earlier that there are some things that you've seen in the last couple of days, and you look at some of the material that has been produced, and you look at it and you think, how the bloody hell did they do this? The amount of effort that went into three or four colour covers on stencil, running it all the way right through, that was pushing the limits of what the technology was available. If you think about the way that fanzines have progressed and how they're going and how they're going forward, which we'll talk about in a minute, it's basically following along with technological innovations. We have now these little fellas. And by the way, I should have also mentioned that I'm recording this, by the way, so that if you say something that you don't want to... it's a bit late. But nobody said anything, I think, that's contentious up until this stage. But if you decide that you want to say something that's contentious, be aware of the fact that it's going down on the permanent record and that this will be kept forever. But basically immutable artefact. This is what it's going to be. I'm not going to edit this afterwards. Otherwise, I'd be putting this little bit back at the beginning. So what we were talking about is that the past. So we've got a bit of a run through about the past, and where are we now in terms of the present? Where, Alan, you haven't said anything yet. He hasn't had a chance. So where do you see us now
I came into fanzines in the early 80s, and I can remember originally typing up contributions on my portable typewriter, which is the only thing I had at home, and they'd end up in Ethel as cut and paste and stuck in, and then photocopied at that point.
So you came in with the classic cut and paste. This was cutting out the bits of paper slightly off square, and if you didn't do it properly and get the white out around, you could just see the little shadow of the bit that you cut out. But you were using photocopiers.
Photocopiers. And I remember when I was working down at South Melbourne, I could access the work photocopier there, and the highlight was where I worked out how to put blue ink on part of the page and run it through again on the black ink. Ooh. And a couple of Ethel, it's got black and white cover, but there's a blue bit across the bottom in blue ink, and that was the highlight of my sort of access technology at the time, done through work. Nowadays, I think, we've pretty much gone, well, I can think nowadays the standard is what I'd call PDF and printout. And so Ethel the Aardvark, which is the MSFC, this is the current one. I'm lucky enough to be a life member, and I still insist on getting a hard copy mailed out to me every time, but it is also emailed out as PDFs, and I think more probably go out as PDFs than
most of them
printing.
Go as PDFs.
Yeah.
The people like PDFs because that one you get the pictures as black and white, except for the colour cover, which Linda's got to deal with David L. Russell. If you get the PDF, all the images inside are in colour.
And the other thing these days is printing a PDF. This is half of the current and Zapper mailing, which I brought along to do my my mailing comments on. And there was, I think, six people in this room who will have contributed to this mailing.
You have to print it.
It basically comes as a PDF, but I've got free printing at work, so I still go in and print it out. But it's stored as, and as James said, it can be colour and facing the PDF, but when you go to print it out, you can grey shade it and cut it down to make it more accessible and things. So, and I'm just thinking, and we're talking current days with e-fanzines and e-fanac, basically an uploaded PDF there, I think everyone is going that way these days.
Well, we'll move on to that with a little bit more in terms of what's going to be happening in the future, but with the technology that's there, basically the advent of the laptop computer, so the Apple II back... When did I buy my first Apple II? When I had a job, about 1980, so 40-odd years ago. So that was about when the first one that I purchased. There were a few more smaller ones around prior to that that did word processing. The hardest problem you had at that point was getting a printer because there was no very good printers that were around. I remember I had some dodgy setup that printed off to an IBM Selectric didn't work all that well.
Darling invented software for that.
Oh, well, I probably was ended up using his from Adelaide.
But David Grigg wrote software, word processing software. In the middle 80s, early the 80s? Very strange software where the... which I couldn't use, but in fact, the word you're writing is always in the middle of the screen. So everything moved around.
No, it doesn't sound terribly good. So basically what it came to was that things changed very markedly in terms of the fanzines that were around in the 70s.
Yeah.
They were still... There was that crossover period, wasn't there? And that always happens. When new technology comes in, when it first turns up, it's expensive. I don't know terribly many people that ever had a photocopier at home. Maybe there might have been some fans or who did that didn't. I never did. But most of us purloined office equipment from where we worked. You sort of decided that you were going to do a bit of late work and make sure that everybody left before you did things.
No, done that too.
It was a duty upon the lowest paid employee in the office to make sure that the photocopier was fully functional at all times.
Oh, okay.
A couple of reams of paper after everyone had left.
Oh, there you go. Just to make sure that it was still working overnight so that the next day everybody would go. Yeah, that's right.
We had a lovely photocopier where I was working and I was in charge of them. And people used to say to me, how do you get that shiny black printout? The first couple of fanzines I did, the black was shiny because it was just the way that the photocopiers worked. I've never seen another photocopier like it. But you know, it was a lovely machine.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people were using those particular type of things. Now, we're only talking here about the production methods. We're not really talking
about the actual writing.
About the actual writing of the fanzines.
Sorry, content. Because
the content.
Art is an important part of it too.
So, you've covered a fair bit of things in the sense of basically saying that a lot of it was the communication between fans. So there's always been the idea of, if you like, the editorials, the main articles, but the letters of comment, which are always the major thing. I think that you did put that point, that there are zines around, so there's the music ones, the sporting ones, or just poetry ones, or just the zines that crop up that you hear people talking about. They don't talk to each other.
No.
They are just there as a small... They all strike me when I go and have a look at them. There's no community. You get no sense of community here.
Yeah.
They may be swapped, they may be handed around, but there doesn't seem to be any sort of interaction between the two of them between the issues that appear to be inside the zines. You're going to tell me something different.
No, I just had little insight. And the reason why I'm not a science fiction writer and out there at this convention is because science fiction writers may drink with each other, but a book or a short story is a book and a short story, and that's it. That's all there is. There's no communication between short stories. Short stories don't talk to each other in the way that there is a letter column in a fanzine talking about this or that article or what this looked like. And maybe I've just had this insight, that's why I'm not a science fiction writer, is because what interests me is the communication, not the art itself. And maybe there is an art to writing fiction, but it doesn't interest me because it's not going to get the kind of response that I like getting out of fanzines. Maybe that's why there are a few of us here, and they're all out there, don't know why they're interested. Why they're not here.
There are a number of fanzines around that are being produced at the moment, what I look at, and I can't quite work out how they fit into the community because there doesn't seem to be any communication between this issue and the next, and nor between its issue and its readers.
They don't have the letters of comment with addresses where you can write to people, and they don't have the list of trades. Pages of, I mean, Ethel, three or four pages of zines we traded with.
Oh, we used to trade.
And things like that.
Well, lots of these things were there purely and simply to build the community up.
Yeah. I'm going to say, I think the letter calls where you can write to each other, that is very hard now. Even when we were doing Plotter, as soon as we started putting it online, it became clear that at the time we still put people's email addresses online. We still did people's physical addresses online. Now people are extremely careful about putting any information because of the possibility of internet pylons. It is normally actually very easy to get in contact with anyone in science fiction fandom if you try.
Yep.
Probably as easy as it's ever been, but you probably have to do the work yourself rather.
It's sort of like that 10 degrees of whatever. If you know somebody, they'll know somebody who can pretty much connect you with somebody eventually.
It's one of the things I like about Octothorpe is you start talking about.
It's got a letter column.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, the interesting thing, I don't, for the major fanzine I produce, Periscope, I don't have anybody's addresses, either email or addresses in them, because I'm fully cognizant of the fact that a lot of people, they're writing to me specifically, they're not necessarily giving me the okay to utilize, to publish their email addresses because of all the scraping that goes on, and people get annoyed by the fact that they get swamped with a whole lot of crap that they don't want. And, you know, I don't think it's fair to set that up for other people. You can find things, and if you really wanted to, if somebody was of my readership was to come to me and say, look, I need to get a hold of this particular person, could you send me their email address? The way I do it is then I write to the person that they're trying to get a hold of to say, this person wants to talk to you, is that okay? And then I have to get permission that way, because I just don't think it's terribly fair to allow it. Whereas, if you go back to old fanzines, you will see addresses everywhere. Now, because of that time, where email addresses started, what, in Australia, 94, 95, somewhere around there, I think, had my first email address about that time, then prior to that, it was all mail.
Yeah.
Physical mail addresses. Physical mail addresses were fine, because if you got something you didn't want, you just chuck it in the bin without even opening it. You didn't have to worry about it.
So spammers back in the day would have to pay for
this. They have to pay for the postage. And if you really wanted to annoy them, you could send it back saying, not notice this address. And they basically, then they would cop it all crap coming back to them. That's, things have changed. So... again, what we're coming up to here is the way that we run and create the material for our fanzines is being dictated to by the technology that's available at the time, because there are implications of the technology that we're using that we have to be cognizant of to ensure that all of the readers that are around are basically being looked after properly. I have... For my fanzine, which I publish about once every month or 5 weeks, I have about 70 or 80 people that I send the thing to specifically first off. If anybody writes to me and asks me to have it sent to them straight away, I will send it to them without any problem. But I always send it out in a blind CC so that nobody gets to see the other ones. And I've got a big note up on my top of my desk, mass mail outs are always BCCs. Because I don't think it's fair that I spread somebody else's email address around without their permission. If you think about it, when it was all postage, you didn't know. If somebody didn't write and you didn't print their address, you didn't know who else was getting this. And I think that's a fair way of doing things. The other way that we distribute these days, which has been different in the past, of course, which has been mentioned, is the two major fanzine repositories, if you like, which are... FANAC, which is run by Edie Stern and Joe Sicleri out of the US. I'm a member of the board of that, so I'm on the committee of that, and I'm the Australian representative. So we will be doing a bit of a pitch for that a bit later on in just a minute. It's not that we're asking for money, not at all. We're not looking for money, so that's good. We're looking for material. The other one, which is run by Bill...
Burns.
I keep on wanting to call him Bill Bowers all the time. I always get that bloody wrong. Bill Burns, he runs it where basically you send a copy of your fanzine to him in a PDF form. He makes it and puts it available and then publicises it on the front page of his website. And then also you'll find if you're on a number of the email lists or digest lists, he will list what he's basically put up there. At the moment... you might think there's not many fanzines being produced. But basically, he's putting up 4, 5, 6 a week. Now, some of those are small. Some of those, if it's from a certain gentleman down in Greensboro in Melbourne, bloody enormous. Bruce Gillespie will put something out at 120 pages and then complain that he's still got more material that he can't find time for and he can't get to. But all this stuff is available for free for download. You can just go in there and you can download it and read it.
And print it
if you want. This stuff's all there available. And really, you should be out there having a bit of a look at it and downloading the stuff that you want. Yeah. And basically, get in contact with the fanzine editor and say, could you add me to your direct list straight away so you get it as soon as it's produced?
Yeah.
People will send it to you. There's absolutely no problem about doing that. You get it straight away and then get back into the community of sending email letters of comment. But there's a difficulty with electronic fanzines, which I've had many discussions with Bruce Gillespie regarding this, because Bruce has only just moved over from print copies over to PDFs because he just can't afford to do it anymore, because they just cost a bloody fortune, not only to print, but also to post. Postage is awful. It's really horrendous at the moment. So, and it's not going to get any better. So anyway, the major problem you've got is that when you actually had a print fanzine in front of you, it was a physical reminder all the time that you had to do something to thank somebody for having sent it to you. You get an email, it comes in, it lands in your inbox. Now, if you're like me, you're going to get maybe 8, 10, 20, 40, 50 other emails in the day. You're going to delete all the crap that you don't want. You're going to move it around. You're going to answer a couple. 2 days later, that fanzine or the email with that fanzine was attached to is now no longer on your front sheet, your front page of your inbox. It's forgotten. So you've either got to do things like certain people do who print them out, and that is a reminder, or maybe just printing the front cover is not a bad idea. So that you basically have some method of being able to remind yourself that you need to respond to them. And it's a bit of a problem at the moment that I'm having to try and deal with, because I keep coming, I was like, oh, I must really reply to this fanzine. And the next thing I know, I realise 6 months gone past and there's a new issue come out. Yeah. I'm like, oh, bloody hell, I didn't do the last one. So I missed that. So you have to basically keep going. So that's part of the problem that we have as a consequence of the new technology that we're using.
Yeah. I just want to move on a little bit. I forgot what I was going to say. Keep going. That's what comes from, you know, drinking too much with some people.
Oh, is that right? Yeah. Drinking too much with me somewhere.
Yeah. So The point is, and maybe this is moving it on a little bit, but I got interviewed for an American podcast several weeks ago. And to do that, I listened to some of the previous podcasts, and they had a podcaster, a force in active fandom was the phrase, and he was talking about how if you go to a convention as a podcaster and you sit up there talking about podcasting, and people say, "How do you do it?" From the audience, "How do you do podcasting? I want to get into podcasting." And it reminded me that many years ago, back in the 70s, you would have a panel on fanzines. And you talk about fanzines, people say, "How do you do it?" And it seems to me that the technology has changed so that instead of people learning how to communicate through fanzines, they're now trying to learn to communicate in other ways, and podcasting is one of them, because that's what the technology allows you to do, so that you are using podcasts to communicate with people in a similar way to fanzines, except that the technology is different, and therefore, to some extent, it's more immediate because you have voices as well. And once again, I think it's just a matter of moving with moving technology. There's a lot of... Another area I play in scale modelling, there's a lot of videos and podcasting where people have suddenly discovered this technology. Previously, they would write articles which they hoped the magazines would publish, and these days they can do it themselves. They've actually discovered a sort of... There have never been any scale modelling magazines, but as soon as the technology opens up, that you can actually put a picture of you gluing two pieces together, and you can now do it in colour... moving, while someone overvoices how you glue two pieces together. As soon as this technology becomes available, then people start using it.
Mm.
Do you have any comments from a Guffish perspective? Would you like to come and join us?
I don't know. I was... Because originally I was told, "Oh, Alison, join the panel." And then I thought,
Now
it's recorded for posterity. Yeah, now I do have to do that.
All right.
I have a plug, first of all, which has nothing to do with Guff. And I definitely don't want your money for Guff. However, I have 10 copies of Sue Mason's TAF report with me.
Okay.
So if you would like a copy of Sue Mason's TAF report and you have a shiny $10 bill...
Oh, yeah, we can do that.
I should be able to figure that out.
Okay, so I probably have to keep a couple because people just told me to say them for them. But, so that's for TAF, not Guff. I wanted to pick up a little bit about... You've talked about podcasting as though...
Well,
kind of
just
new
about
thing.
To come
course,
to that.
Podcasting is quite an old thing now. And I wanted to mention too, because what I am about is the building of communities. So the reason I love fanzines and the sort of podcast I do where we do indeed get people to write in and then talk about what they've said, is because I'm really interested in community building. I'm in fandom, not quite like science fiction, but I'm mostly about the community of fans and hence fanzines, which do indeed build that community. Two things you may or may not be aware of are BookTube and BookTok.
And they are big, big communities where people are, and the thing about them is that they are doing the thing that you talk about, because people are very much engaging with each other in terms of talking about them. Now, personally, I don't, they're mostly quite young, and they're mostly not engaging about the books to quite the depth I would like them to. So an awful lot of BookTok and BookTuber people going, you've got to read this, it's amazing, and I would rather hear a little bit about why it's amazing, and indeed if it actually is. But you know, but the principle there, they feel to me like those people are doing the stuff that we used to do in terms of enthusing about things and creating a community of people who enthuse about things. So podcasting is quite old now. My fanzine, which was a proper we did it in Microsoft Word for many years, which is, I don't recommend doing a fanzine in Word, because but now
this is produced on WordPerfect. It's a paper.
Fantastic.
WordPerfect allows you to do things you can't do in Word.
That's true.
Yeah, and that's why I must still use WordPerfect.
I guarantee you, I could produce everything you've done there in Word without any
difficulty. I used to use Word.
Oh, and I looked at Word and I remember my brain.
But anyway, but Plokta was designed to be a fanzine that was designed to look like a magazine. Was like designed to be reasonably well produced and have a professional look about the way it was put together. We didn't always succeed in that, but I go back and look at the physical issues, because there are physical issues, and go, well, actually that stands up quite well even now with what's being done in fanzines. I Galactic Journey, which I'm a contributor to, is a fanzine. It's an online fanzine. That's a website that produces a thing every two days. But you could kind of, when Gideon Marcus is producing the month's worth of issues, he knows what he's of stories. He knows what's going in for the month. He's editing it the way a fanzine editor would. It is immutable once it's there, and it's doing very many of the things you would want. And I explained, but Gideon's got no experience with kind of PDFs. He understands about paper fanzines because the shtick of Galactic Journey is that it's going through life 55 years in behind, so they're currently in 1968, so it's every 2 days there's a new article about the time in 1968. I do know, it's quite a lot of fans, and in fact one of the things that's amusing about it is that every so often a fan who remembers that went through that experience in 1968 comments to say, you are totally wrong about this and this is why, and whoever has written the article says, but actually one of the things we're doing is reflecting with the perspective of history. And but I explained to him about PDF fanzines and about what, and he was like, but why would anybody create content and then put it in a PDF? He understood why fanzines existed in 1968 because that was what you had, but he was like, well, why would you make new content and create it as a PDF in the way that, say, Azapa does it? And because I'm one of the people who does this, I totally understand why you do it, of the actual benefit of producing a little self-contained craft project that has more in common with those art zines than you think, because even though it's in dialogue with the community, as we say in the 21st century, you finish a zine.
So what's,
you
go, so what
oh,
was?
No, I feel like that reflects something about what I am.
So what was his reasons for why does he think that this is a strange thing to be doing? Because it just doesn't understand it.
Just doesn't see why you do a PDF. So I thought it was interesting because people like Gideon are definitely people that we want in our community.
With the chair, you will recognise Rose.
So to that, Alison, we're going to digress, but this is a science fiction.
So we're allowed to digress anywhere we want.
So I'm just curious, Neil, and you must be running through your head as well, because you're in publishing, is how does he create the artifact in the first place? Because everything has to be a PDF to send it to a printer.
That's website.
This is a website. Yeah, Galactic Journey is a website that gets published every couple of days. Now, the interesting thing about this is that every now and again, somebody doesn't understand the shtick and puts in a comment that comes up and says, well, why don't you just Google this? And the response is, what's Google? Because you have to, it's 1968. This is the whole point. This is the whole thing about, and this is why this is such a, it's such a wonderful thing. And it's probably the close. I was going to. I've run a weblog, and I ran a weblog for about 7 years on Australian literature. I did not think that it was anything at all like a fanzine. However, Galactic Journey is as close, in my view, to a classic fanzine that I would see it as, something like this, as you can possibly get, because it's not little bits and pieces popping up every 5 or 10 minutes. Something crops up, and it's a long article written by one particular person. Mm. It may well be that Allison writes stuff about fandom in the 1960s. There's somebody else who reviews every issue of Analog. Somebody else does something else. Somebody will come out and review 2 or 3 books that have just appeared. Somebody else will talk about the latest issue or the latest episode of Star Trek and whatever film was out at the time. You're looking at it as if it, everything happened in 1968 as it is at the moment. They review everything. Everything that...
They're about to fall... That, sometime between 1968 and 1970, that's going to fall apart.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
You can see science fiction exploding in the wake of Star Trek.
So it's very interesting because this is a very, very... They, yeah, you're talking about, you've come on to talk about the fandom, which is really good. So the, so there's stuff that's going on there, the fanzines that you're picking up on, and what's...
I said to Gideon, oh, your problem, Galactic Journey, it's a great thing, but, you know, if you're talking about science fiction in the 1960s, you really should be thinking about the fanzines and what's going on in the fanzines. Yeah.
He's
like, oh, so you're saying we need a correspondent to do that, then?
Well, bing. Shouldn't have put your hand up.
But because you're right to the extent that I'm reading a Terry Carr fanzine from whom sometime, and there's John Foister and Philip Dick disagreeing with each other over a point, which helps to shape what Philip Dick is going to write in the future.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is the dividing line between fanzine and semi-prozine?
Fiction.
I mean, stuff like File 770.
What? Oh, yes, that...
Yeah, that thing. Even Locus. Yeah.
Well, Locus has been a semi-prozine for quite some period of time.
Yeah.
It started out as a fanzine, but shifted over, basically...
When they paid staff.
When they started paying people, is really what it comes down to. I don't think you can... This is just me. I'm quite happy for other people to sort of have a completely different opinion. I don't think you can be a fanzine if you're being paid. This is an amateur publication.
That goes right back to early fanzines where some people got paid. Contributors often got paid for the early fanzine, for things in the early fanzines.
Well, yeah, okay.
Not in Australia anyhow.
I don't think it happened to you.
Yeah.
Well, nobody ever.
File 770 is absolutely a fanzine in my view. It's doing everything you require of a fanzine.
Yeah,
it happens to be a website.
Yeah,
it's definitely not. 8-page staff. It did a Kickstarter of £500,000. I mean, no, it's not. It's
and then when you come to Australia, what about Andromeda? Where none of the staff gets paid. The computers get paid.
But that's not a fanzine.
I don't look at that. It might have started out as such. Just because things... If you look at it and you... you know, it's sort of like a duck. If it walks like a duck, quacks like
it's
one,
fiction,
it looks like
fiction.
It. It's mainly fiction.
It comes back... It actually comes to the point of whether you publish fiction or not. And there have been early Australian fanzines before the war, lots of fiction. Sydney fanzines after the war, nothing, because we don't denigrate science fiction. But Ron Clark, Dennis Stocks are publishing fiction in their fanzines, whereas I don't think a Melbourne fan would have... Well, just why would you bother publishing fiction that's in the prozines?
Yes.
Yeah, so lots of... When you start looking at fanzines and their development in other countries, you do see lots of fiction, especially... And the more the country doesn't have an established science fiction press, the more likely it is to generate a culture of fanzines that have a lot of fiction in it. because I mean, as you said, there's not.
It's more about the science fiction press in that country,
exactly,
as opposed to the community. I can understand that.
So if you're a community of science fiction readers and nobody in your country is publishing science fiction that reflects your experiences and your traditions, then you're going to put that in your
fanzines. Yes, that makes sense.
Not, you know, if you're an American or a Brit or probably also an Australian, there's plenty of stuff that actually reflects your experiences and your traditions.
Rose again.
Well, it brings up the question of fan fiction.
I wouldn't touch it, but that's because it's badly written.
Well, that you can put fan fiction in a publication and call it a fanzine, and I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
But that's not the fanzine that I publish, and that's right. I'm not denigrating him at all. We haven't talked. That's why we've been. That's why we've been basically staying off content, other than to talk about those zines that are produced in other communities that, for me, don't talk to each other. But there are some that fanzines that you will get on a regular basis turning up on e-fanzines, which to all intents and purposes will look like a fanzine, but I read them and I go, there's no sense of community here. Yeah. I'm not seeing connections between them. Yes, Rose.
So going back to the gentleman at the back's point...
Ian Nichols.
Nico to his friends.
Wouldn't it was explained to me way back when is that with a fanzine, it didn't have a cover. This is a crude explanation. I didn't have a cover price. It was given in exchange that vanished cover.
The early Australian fanzines had prices.
That's a privilege as well, because that is another way to ensure that your hobby can only be conducted by people who have spare time.
Well, that was explained to me in 1992.
Basically, a lot of fanzines. First off, they would have a price to cover the cost of the postage, just to make sure. And then, so it's usually say there's a certain part or the usual.
The usual is
some level of communication. Either a trade that you figure out in advance or a letter of comment. So that's the community that they're trying to push. And there are a number of people that will say, unless you put the usual at the top in your colophon, that is, you know, the bit where you have your title, which a lot of people don't do.
No.
In fanzine. So I start reading a fanzine, I have no idea. If I haven't looked at the cover and looked at the back page, I don't know who the bloody hell. I don't know what the fanzine is. I don't know who it's from, and I don't know what it's about because they don't put stuff at the beginning. I mean, I just have this old. I'm old school. I'm old fashioned. I like putting something up the top that says, "This is what you're reading. This is who produced it. This is the date. This is the number. This is where you can get in contact with me, and this is where you can get whatever else plus the acknowledgements." That I want to put in at the end, and then I like to have page numbers, and I like to have page numbers, and I like. Oh, this is a bit of a slag off at him because he didn't have page numbers in this thing. He said it's on page 4. I said, what bloody page 4? Go find it. And I also like to have the title on every page, so that when I'm going through it, if I'm digging through, look, if you have a look through. And this is just me, right? But now we're talking about formatting and so on. I look through a lot of stuff in NZAPA, which I'm a member of, and you can basically go through. And look, I'll have to tell you what I do first off. When I get an issue of NZAPA, which is PDF, 600 pages these days, right? 600 pages every 2 months. I do an ego scan. How do I do an ego scan? I open it up, an Acrobat, Adobe Acrobat. I put Perry Middlemiss, or just Perry at the top, and then I hit find. And it gets me, and it jumps me into the middle of the fanzine, and I've got no idea what the fanzine is. Because it's got nothing at the top. I don't know what page I'm on. I have to then scroll back to the bit. I'm saying that what we need to do is you need to utilise the technology, but you also need to be aware of the way people are going to read it and the way they're going to consume it. And unfortunately, I ego scan first off. Look for my name.
You've got to be aware of how Perry reads fanzines.
that uncanny traps. I recently
put Perry in every paragraph.
Put Perry in every paragraph in your own.
I recently...
Hang on, Ian.
So I recently did the ego scan myself. My name's Abra, but then I found out my name, Alan, is also in the middle of New Zealand. Which ends up a lot in
just
a Zappa.
Just for Alan's space. It's not rocket
which
science.
Is the, which is the Australian... But from a thing at work, basically, which we now put in, basically, if I had a handle paid for this, basically, and I dropped them, I want to be able to pick them up and put them into order easily. And if there's no headers or footers or page numbers, it's a lot of a problem.
Oh, that is a problem. There we are.
So that's another plus for the way you want us to do things. And where before, I work in publishing... Yes,
yeah. In a second, I just want to say that as a historian, the thing I hate most about fanzines is not having a date on them and what's not on this.
No date.
Yes.
Jack Herman once explained to me why there shouldn't be numbers on the pages of fanzines.
Yeah.
He said that it made that great Fanish Olympics event, Collatio, far too easy.
Anyway, look, we're getting close to the end of our time
talk about
here.
Talk briefly about what's the future.
Right, well, okay, we do need to talk about a little bit briefly about the future. And I think our major thread all the way right through this has been technology. And I think that's what we need to think about with technology. Now, we've had somebody down the end here saying that podcasts are old news.
Or getting old.
Getting old news. But in terms of how old, what was the first fanish SF podcast that you can think of?
Well, so Jim Mowat did a fanzine on CD, and I don't think he was the first to do that.
Yeah.
So I think there's been a few where people have done audio fanzines and distributed
Roman Ozersky did one on cassette.
Distributed them that way. So
what about the podcast as we know it now, where basically we're sitting here, we're recording it, and we're going to put it up and make it available on the internet or interwebs somehow. Mm-hmm. 12 years?
Podcasts in general have been going for about 25 years at this point.
Okay. So what, if that's the most recent technology change that we're utilising, what's...
They weren't called podcasts quite then. They acquired the podcast name from iPod in about 2000. Yeah, that sort of time.
Yeah.
I'm going to say about that sort of time.
Right, so we're talking...
I don't know whether we had a science fiction one very early on.
So where are we?
But the reason why the best fancast, Hugo, is a really stupid name, but it just kind of means audio and video.
Yeah.
So would podcasts. Something like you said, your BookTube or BookTalk, would an episode of that become possibly be
last year there was no BookTuber on the fancast Hugo list. This year there is
one. Okay.
Rachel Calandi is a BookTuber. Sure. She's on the list.
People at my work keep saying we should use it, put it on our TV in our library. We've just never quite worked out how to get the formats to work.
Oh, okay. So where do we go to then? So what's happening with the future of fanish production?
Well, I mean, I think this is so everybody's attention is massively divided now. We have far too much going on to possibly pay attention to. You have to choose very judiciously. You're saying, well, why should people pay attention to fan-produced things when there is infinite amounts of professional content that is better? And I my argument would always be because actually it's the community building, creating grassroots communities in all sorts of areas, not just science fiction, is really, really important. It's really what makes life worthwhile. You can't just be a consumer your whole life. And building things in communities is how you do it, especially in a world where we're moving on from... we're not having as many physical conventions as we used to, and I don't think that's necessarily going to change.
Okay.
So we're going back to the need to bring people together through electronic means.
So whatever it is, it's going to be community that's going to bring us together, and that's it. Now, last thing before we finish up, one thing that I wanted to get, because this is probably going to be the only opportunity I'm going to be able to ask about this, we mentioned things like FANAC and eFanzines. What we have to be aware of is that as the fanish community is getting older, we have to be aware as fans that our collections, so if you want to call them that, we don't want to lose them. We don't want to lose all this material. Historians like Lee here live and breathe with this stuff. Without it, it's all completely lost. I had to help rescue somebody's fanish collection just a couple of weeks ago. There's stories about Denny Lean, who passed away very quickly. He's a Minneapolis fan. Had a made...
Oh,
Yeah, had a he died 3-4 months ago.
Yeah.
Had a major collection, and it was all going to head to the dumpster because his the rest of his family just wanted to clear the house out, and fans from all over the country had to swarm in with their cars to haul all the stuff away to make sure it wasn't lost. If you've got this type of material, don't leave it to the last minute. Don't leave it so that nobody knows what to do with it. Firstly, tell all of your fanish friends that you've got this stuff and make sure they know it's there. Secondly, make sure that it's all scanned. Thirdly, write a bloody will. If you do not have a will now, everybody in this room should have a will. If you don't have one, write one. Get one done.
But make because sure that your family know what needs to happen to your
absolutely.
Family. We've just been dealing with my father had world-class collections in several different areas, none of which are science fiction, and in none of those cases have we any idea. They have been dispersed.
Where they have to go to.
We
cannot
find people who you have any of this stuff.
You have to tell your friends, your family and friends, what to do with it all. So make sure that that's all done. Otherwise, this stuff goes. It just gets lost, and we don't want to lose it. But anyway, thank you very much for your attention today. Get back in there, produce more fanzines, and put them up and make them all available. There we are. I suppose you're starting to wonder if this podcast is back up and running now. Well, no. We noted earlier this year that we might have the odd episode here and there, and yes, the two recent ones have certainly been that. As to any others, well, we'll just have to wait and see. Until next time, goodbye.